Hey everybody, welcome back to C3. I'm Ken Dobson, thanks for joining us today. I thought I'd begin this morning with a poem by Philip Levine. Philip Levine is one of my favorite poets, a Detroit native. And I'm gonna read the poem here at the beginning of today's talk, and I'm gonna read it at the end, so you get a chance to hear it twice. It's called The Simple Truth. I bought $1.50 worth of small red potatoes, took them home, boiled them in their jackets, and ate them for dinner with a little butter and salt. Then I walked through the dried fields on the edge of town. In the middle of June, the light hung on the dark furrows at my feet, and in the mountain oaks overhead, the birds were gathering for the night, the jays and mockers squawking back and forth, the finches still darting in the dusty light. The woman who sold me the potatoes was from Poland. She was someone out of my childhood in a pink spangled sweater and sunglasses, praising the perfection of all her fruits and vegetables at the roadside stand and urging me to taste even the pale, raw sweet corn trucked all the way, she swore, from New Jersey. Eat, eat, she said. Even if you don't, I'll say you did. Some things you know all your life. They are so simple and true. They must be said without elegance, meter, and rhyme. They must be laid on the table beside the salt shaker, the glass of water, the absence of light gathering in the shadows of picture frames. They must be naked and alone. They must stand for themselves. My friend Henry and I arrived at this together in 1965, before I went away and before he began to kill himself, and the two of us to betray our love. Can you taste what I'm saying? It is onions or potatoes, a pinch of simple salt, the wealth of melted butter. It is obvious, and it stays in the back of your throat like a truth you never uttered because the time was always wrong. It stays there for the rest of your life, unspoken, made of that dirt we call earth, the metal we call salt, in a form we have no words for, and you live on it. Again, this is a poem from Philip Levine called The Simple Truth. Because some things are so simple and true, they must be said without elegance. If you are just joining us in our at C3 or just recently coming back to C3 in this online format, I guess I'd like to say we're in the middle of a series which I'm calling Meaning Matters, the pursuit of meaning matters. And each month we're taking a look at a new word, and this word, uncomfortably so for the month of January, is truth. And what a week to be talking about truth. What a year, 2020, to be talking about truth. We're suddenly into the contemporary parlance comes words like misinformation, alternative facts, truth, lies, liar, and the list goes on and on. In fact, in some respects, we've been talking about truth all of 2020, intensely and directly, wondering what we mean by such a word. And I wanted to begin with this poem from Philip Levine, because in a sense, it's like the ringing of a church bell in the distant fog, reminding us that there is such a thing. And there's a kind of, maybe we could say, simplicity of truth and plainness of truth that calls to us on the deep level, especially in a world of abstractions and a world of claims and even a world of facts, which are abstract, you know, constructs, you could say. The simple elegance of two people coming to understand something. The simple exchange of words and warmth and the concreteness of small red potatoes and butter and salt. I think the ringing of this bell, the simple truth, in at least it, from my point of view, sort of returns me to my senses. Ah, yes, there it is sort of the feeling. So today I want that poem to frame everything I'm going to say. I'd like to give a little talk here and a little musing, and then I'll read the poem again. And I just want to maybe talk about truth today following two kind of avenues. One, I want to talk about the Bible. And one, I want to talk about Nietzsche. You know, the combination that everyone's using this Sunday, the Bible and Nietzsche. And the reason why I want to start with the Bible is because I woke up this morning and a passage from my childhood rose up from the shelves of my unconscious. And once I picked up that book and opened that page, a whole lot of other verses and images sort of flooded my mind from childhood. And I grew up as a Baptist in the South. And the Bible was really, really important to us. And we committed it to memory. We talked about it. We quoted from it. We used it to scare people. We used it to love people. We had a complex and sincere relationship with the text that has shaped, I guess you could say, the Judeo-Christian world, something like that, for 3,000 years. And of course, as you know from my previous talks and my podcast, it keeps coming up for me, and I keep wondering what it means as a contemporary person to have a relationship with the symbols and the wisdom of our ancestors, including something like the Bible. It's a question that I'm probably will carry to my grave, I suppose. So not a question that's maybe even meant to be answered, but something that I think is worth wrestling with. So I want to read you a little line from the Proverbs here and just make a few comments very generally. And I hope you'll hear these words from Proverbs with a kind of openness, a kind of open heart, and a kind of curiosity. I'm not asking you to believe there's a God or disbelieve there's a God or think that Yahweh's many names in the Hebrew scriptures is the only God. I'll leave these personal existential struggles to your own solitude. But Proverbs is a collection of wisdom sayings. And you know, and I know, we're really struggling right now for wisdom. In a world of tweets, the soul, the heart even, if I can use these metaphors, is starving for wisdom. It's starving for the wisdom of our elders and of our ancestors, starving for the wisdom of earth even. In a world that feels as thin as you know, as the first layer of ice on a pond. So anyway, here's the line from Proverbs. Some of you will recognize it. It's a little bit of a shocker here at the beginning. Six things the Lord hates. I remember hearing this as a kid, like, oh no, oh my God. Six things Yahweh hates. Seven that are an abomination. Now listen carefully to this list. And even if you want to have a certain measure of sophistication here at the beginning and think, well, perhaps they're, you know, as all ancient people and modern people for that matter do, they're projecting parts of the human psyche onto God and the gods. Okay, fine. Don't overanalyze it. Just listen to the list here. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, one who sows discord among brothers and sisters. Do you see what I mean? You know, the golden rule, what is hateful to yourself, do not do unto other people. That's Hillel, or Jesus's way of putting it, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Listen to this list again. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, one who sows discord among brothers and sisters. This is minimum 2,500 years old. And it's like, collectively, at our worst moments, we're nowhere near following these wisdom teachings. The Proverbs are interesting, along with many of the other sort of wisdom sayings in the Bible. I mean, people get the wrong impression because they hear that the Bible has laws in it. And here a little Hebrew is helpful because the word law in Hebrew is Torah, and Torah means teaching. So it's probably more accurate to call it the teachings rather than the law, because that makes it sound like everything in there is, you know, like a speed limit is a law, that kind of thing. But actually, the vast majority of them are maybe what we would even call moral teachings, ethical precepts, images, like the images that I just shared with you, that are meant to work on us and challenge us. And I think this list is worth hearing. And even if you don't identify as a Christian or find yourself in some kind of post-Christian place, or if you do in some way find yourself connected to the story of Jesus, culturally, in Western America in the 21st century, Christianity, and particularly the Bible, sort of hovers around in the background. Think about that terrible image of Trump standing in front of that Episcopal church after the tear gas had cleared the air, holding the Bible. See what I mean? So some attention is worth, it's worth giving our attention to. That's what I would say, even intellectually. But I think more importantly, on the level of the heart, we might say. Because it used to be in the old world, and by old world, I mean, I don't know, I'll let you define that. It used to be in the old world that part of education we took to mean, without even needing a definition, a kind of moral education. And that has fallen out of fashion, we could say. Moral education, we'd say, is none of the business of the state, we might say. Although that's never true, because you expect your students not to cheat. That's a kind of moral education. So, but we say, we don't need that. And in fact, it was too heavy-handed. Okay, fair enough. But let's just be honest. Human beings have a hard time growing up. Young people have a hard time growing up. Adults, still, many of them, have not grown up. When it comes to the level of morality and ethics and integrity and consistency and truth and honesty and authenticity, we all need some help. We're all prone to stray, we could say. So I just wanted you to hear a little bit of ancient wisdom. And what struck me after reading this, and I started to wonder to myself, how many passages in the biblical text are related to not telling the truth? And a very quick survey revealed nothing short of hundreds. Hundreds of passages. Hundreds of passages communicate in one way, shape, or form, don't lie. Tell the truth. Be honest. Don't bear false witness. Don't make up crap about people. So clearly, if it's in there hundreds of times, people were doing it. And clearly, if it's in there hundreds of times, people today in the 21st century, with all of our sophistication and all of our science and all of our technology, are still prone to do it. And this week we saw, you know, a disturbing example of what happens when leaders sow seeds of falsehoods, what the consequences of that might be. And that ought to be a lesson. And I'm not trying to pick at the right, because you've probably heard me be a little more nuanced in recent months about, I think there's a place for tradition and the conservative disposition. I think it's part of the human psyche. It's part of the human makeup. We actually know this, you know, scientifically, you could say. And there's a place for the progressive, liberal, innovative disposition. There's a place for both. And what happens when, I kind of feel for the conservative movement right now, because many of them have legitimate, valid arguments about what civil society and what America looks like, which can't be heard right now in because of the smoke screen of all the madness, like what happened at the Capitol. So what's my main point here? My main point, I think, is that it's a lesson that even the smallest seeds of falsehoods have very serious consequences. See, I think there's a difference, and I think this is worth saying here. There's a difference between not telling the truth because you don't know the truth and lying. And something like a searching moral inventory is needed to parse those out. I'm sure I've said lots of things that aren't true. And I'd like to, I'd like the blinders to come off at a certain point. But that kind of not telling of the truth, I hope, is done with a sort of innocence. I simply didn't know. I didn't know. And part of growing up into a mature human being is opening yourself up to that possibility and good old-fashioned learning from your mistakes. So there's a difference between that, which we're all prone to do, because we're all fed certain kinds of information. We all process things in a certain way. We all perceive the world in a certain way. There's a difference between that and an outright lie, which is, I know this isn't true, but it's going to serve me in some way, or serve the cause in some way, or manipulate another human being or an organization or a movement just enough so that it serves my aims. And I'm bringing this up because the easy thing to do right now, and people have been doing it all over the news media and articles, and is, you know, come after Trump and his falsehoods and so forth. But that's kind of old news at this point. I'm asking something like, what if we elevated to the highest order, in a certain degree, the pursuit of trying to tell the truth as best we can and trying to eliminate our everyday conversation, try to eliminate the lies in our everyday conversation. Instead of, what I'm a little bit afraid of, is that, especially with all this impeachment talk, is that while we can quickly make Trump into the scapegoat and drive him out of town and throw him off a cliff. That's actually what they did with the scapegoat, by the way. That's where the word comes from the book of Leviticus, to speak of the Bible. In any case, and I'm not making a political claim whether or not it's a good idea. I don't know if it's a good idea, but I'm saying psychologically, if we put all the blame on Trump, and then it's a mistake. That's what I would say. It's a mistake by the left. And really, something deeper ought to be disturbing us. How do we let our politics get to this kind of place? The people that are supposed to represent us. How do we let our public discourse get to be like this? How do we let the news media get to be so partisan, where it literally makes millions of dollars, billions of dollars for itself being partisan on both sides? How do we let this happen? Why did we let this happen? Those are hard questions, and I think sobering ones, in my view. So maybe just to close the point number one here on the Bible, I don't know, asking yourself, do I value truth-telling? Do I want to be a truthful person? Do I want to be a trustworthy person? That came up last week and also in our talk back. I do want to be a trustworthy person. I want to try to tell the truth. I want to stop lying in whatever ways I can. And I want to promote that publicly as an alternative to the zeitgeist of the moment, we could say. And we've now seen what happens when leaders spread enough lies and sows enough seeds of discourse, just what will happen. And that ought to disturb us. So just another word on the word etymology of truth, which I mentioned just in passing in last week's talk, and it comes from faithfulness. Consistency, fidelity, loyalty are synonyms. That's interesting. It gives you a sense of the origin of what we meant by truth, to be faithful, to be consistent. In other words, being truthful, being true is what a word like truth was meant to point us toward. Not so much, which is what I think is interesting, not so much abstract claims, sort of subject, object, abstract claims we call truth, but the origin of the word points us in a slightly different direction toward embodying and being truthful as much as we can. That's what we mean. And that's why I think it's so interesting. Someone brought up in TalkBack, which, by the way, if you're new to this, sign up for our newsletter. You can get a link. And immediately after this teaching at 11 o'clock every single week, we have a TalkBack. And it's just a Zoom chat room, and we talk about what we heard. I learned something every week. Like last week, someone brought up trustworthiness. What an interesting phrase. Worthy of someone's trust. That's what I want to be. I want to be a trustworthy person, even if at times I'm wrong or I don't tell the truth, or I mistakenly say something that's not true, which we're all prone to do. The aim is something like, be someone worthy of trusting. How do we let our politicians reflect the opposite of that? And I'm not just picking on one side here. If you stop the average person on the street and ask them, are politicians trustworthy? What are they going to say? They're going to say, no, not really. Some, but it's almost goes hand in hand now. We expect from our leaders that they would be untrustworthy. Perhaps that's why, by the way, at the beginning, when someone new emerges on the scene and people attach themselves to that individual, thinking something like, I think unconsciously, this person is the Messiah. Not that they would say that out loud, but there's a kind of zeal because the feeling is something like, maybe this person will be trustworthy. Maybe this person will represent my hopes, desires, and aims in an honest, straightforward, truthful way, unlike everybody else. So of course there's a lot of zeal, only to be let down once again. And of course, human beings always let human beings down. You don't believe me? Try something like any form of long-term committed relationship. You will find yourself being a disappointment and letting down your partner. So I understand it's part of the human condition, but I think you see what I'm getting at. How do we let there kind of be a sort of, it's synonymous that politicians and leaders and people in power would be untrustworthy. Huh. I thought of something Heschel said that is analogous to what I'm saying. So he was in a conversation once with a priest and from Notre Dame, and they were talking about the afterlife. And Heschel said something like this, I'll paraphrase, he said, the question is not, is there an afterlife and will I get to go there? It's not, is there an afterlife and will I get to go there? The question is, am I living the kind of life now that is worthy of extending into the future? See, now that's classic sort of rabbinic twist of things. And it's an important question. Do I want to live the kind of life that's worthy of extending into the future? Because here's the truth, in my opinion. All of us are living right now a kind of eternity. The choices we're making, the decisions we're making, whether or not we're living, being trustworthy and honest, it's having a ripple effect in a pond. And we can see that with what happened in the Capitol. You keep throwing falsehoods into the pond and those ripples are going to go somewhere. And it doesn't just end because Trump is not in office or, when Trump is gone. We live right now with a kind of blurring of the lines between now and the future. In other words, the choices we're making now have a kind of eternal effect. And I'm saying eternal sort of metaphorically, but I think you get the gist of what I'm saying. So what kind of life do I want to live on the everyday level? Do I want to be trustworthy? If someone's trustworthy, even if I disagree with all of their politics, I can have a relationship with them. I want a relationship with them. I think, well, I may disagree, but man, they are trustworthy. And that's slipping from our shared values. And that's kind of what I'm hoping to challenge a bit. So let me just say something real brief about Nietzsche. So he's got a lot of things to say about truth. And I want to read you one of them. He says, what is truth? A movable host of metaphors. His writing is unbelievable. He can say more in a sentence than, you know, I can say in all of my podcasts and books combined. What is truth? A movable host of metaphors, a sum of human relations which have been poetically and rhetorically intensified, transferred, and embellished, and which, after long usage, seem to people to be fixed. Now, he's talking about the way in which our language is without question metaphoric. Otherwise, there would be only one language, for example. No, it functions in a kind of metaphoric way in a series and systems of relationships. When we look outside and we see a leaf, how do we know it's a leaf? Well, we know it metaphorically because it's in relationship to other things we call leaves. So these, by the way, are the first seeds of a kind of relativism when it comes to perspective, but not quite the ground of what we would call postmodernism, just like the early seeds here. But I'm not a philosophical expert on postmodernism anyway. So this is what's interesting about Nietzsche. You would think he would say, if it's a movable mountain of metaphors, there's no such thing as truth. No, he's saying truth is a movable mountain of metaphors. And this is what it calls for. In light of this kind of realization that my perspective and your perspective is in relationship to this movable mountain, which it causes at least a little bit of existential freak out, the question is, how should we live? This is what Nietzsche says. What's needed is a moral impulse in regard to truth. And to lie, he's being a bit facetious, to lie according to fixed convention. So I'm going to read this again. What's needed in light of this is a moral impulse in regard to truth. To lie according to fixed convention. What he's saying is to play the game, these are my interpretations, within the movable mountain of language, and to have a kind of moral approach toward it, to try to tell the truth as best we can, to try to be understood and to try to understand. See, that's an interesting and I think profound conclusion in light of the relativity of language, of language being a social construct and things like this, which can lead straight to nihilism. He's saying, no, it's time for a kind of moral impulse to rise up, and I'm interpreting, to try to tell the truth as best we can, to try to say things simply and clearly, and to try to listen for the truth and in a kind of simple and clear-headed way. And maybe just by way of question, just to stir the pot here. If truth is relational, according to Nietzsche, if truth is relational, what's your relationship like with the truth? What is your relationship like with things that come into your orbit that you do not think are true? What's the relationship like? Is it I have to cut myself off from anything bumping into my world that might challenge it? Or is it more open? Like, well, as far as I can see, this is the case, but I might be wrong. And what would it look like to open up relationally? See, and if I bring it back to being trustworthy, and faithful and honest, and authentic and simple, that kind of energy makes it more possible for sides around an issue or perspective or way of looking at the world to have a conversation that leads to a relationship. Well, we need our relationships, more consciousness around the complex relationships of the metaphors that we call language and truth. We need more relationship, not less. At least it seems to me. So maybe I'll say it personally. I'd like to try to tell the truth. I'd like to try to tell the truth, to play the game, in other words, to seek to understand, to seek to be understood as much as I can, and to act in a trustworthy fashion. And I think this kind of attitude can help us wrestle some meaning out of the chaos of the 21st century, of 2021 now, to wrestle some meaning out of the chaos. And maybe one more thing as a kind of aside. One of the reasons, maybe to bring it back to the Bible, is that the Bible has a pretty raw and sometimes negative, but also positive, view of human nature. And that's true also in Buddhism, that's true in Islam, that's true in Hinduism. There's a truth in the great religious traditions that they look into the human heart and they see what we now might call, from a depth psychology point of view, our shadow elements, our instinctual drives, the parts of ourselves that we're not too proud of or that we don't even know that much about. Before depth psychology, there was religion, we could say. And I like that human nature is complex. And I didn't really like something that people started saying after these, after the riots in the Capitol. They kept saying, this is not who we are. And my wife actually first said, that's an interesting phrase. This is not who we are. And I understand rhetorically what perhaps Biden and others are doing by saying this is not who we are. They're trying to call us to something higher, and that I can say, yep, that's noble. But the truth is that this is who we are. This is part of America. I'm a student of history, and just read history if you want to find out how poorly we behave, how poorly we behave in mobs, how poorly we behave on the Senate floor. There's a senator that caned another senator and beat him on the head in the Senate chamber, and he couldn't work for 2 years. Yes, my son told me that because of AP history. So this is who we are. That's not actually that important. The better question is, who do we want to be moving forward? Who are we right now? Well, it's a mixed bag, and sometimes we behave poorly, and sometimes even good people who didn't wake up in the morning and say, I want to burn something down and tear something down, find themselves doing that. This is what mob mentality can do to people. I'm not trying to provide an excuse here, but I'm saying people are complex. And I think it's better to say, yep, we behave like this. And actually, all of us have the capacity to behave astonishingly poor. The better question is, who do we want to be? And what's going to call us toward fidelity, faithfulness, trustworthiness, honesty, authenticity, relationship, dialogue, and keep that banner out ahead of us like a sign of hope, because I think it is. And this talk's getting a little long for my talk, so I'm going to end it here. And I want us to return to The Simple Truth by Philip Levine. The Simple Truth. I bought a dollar and a half's worth of small red potatoes, took them home, boiled them in their jackets, and ate them for dinner with a little butter and salt. Then I walked through the dried fields on the edge of town. In the middle of June, the light hung on the dark furrows at my feet, and in the mountain oaks overhead, the birds were gathering for the night. The jays and mockers squawking back and forth, the finches still darting in the dusty light. The woman who sold me the potatoes was from Poland. She was someone out of my childhood, in a pink spangled sweater and sunglasses, praising the perfection of all her fruits and vegetables at the roadside stand and urging me to taste even the pale, raw sweet corn trucked all the way, she swore, from New Jersey. Eat, eat, she said. Even if you don't, I'll say you did. Some things you know all your life. They are so simple and true. They must be said without elegance, meter, and rhyme. They must be laid on the table beside the salt shaker, the glass of water, the absence of light gathering in the shadows of picture frames. They must be naked and alone. They must stand for themselves. My friend Henry and I arrived at this together in 1965, before I went away and before he began to kill himself, and the two of us to betray our love. Can you taste what I'm saying? It is onions or potatoes, a pinch of simple salt, the wealth of melted butter. It is obvious. It stays in the back of your throat like a truth you never uttered because the time was always wrong. It stays there for the rest of your life unspoken. Made of that dirt we call earth, the metal we call salt, in a form we have no words for, and you live on it. Peace.